Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, December 5th. I'm Ray Graff. It's birds today on the program, and we welcome back Rich Guthrie to answer your questions. Julie Hart was a late scratch today, so bird lovers, you got Rich Guthrie in a solo flight. In fact, he's been making lazy circles around the coffee maker for some time now. Must be riding a thermal. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you have a bird question, or email voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email address, voxpop@wamc.org. And the number is 800-348-2551, the one, the only, Rich Guthrie. And your bird questions coming up after the news. Oh, hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We are discussing birds today on the show, and we welcome our friend, avian expert Rich Guthrie. Julie Hart, a late scratch today. She'll be back next month. Rich is retired from the New York State DEC and is now the regional reviewer for the premier birding site, eBird. The number to call with your birding question is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. Voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email. And the number here is 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie, how are you, my friend?
Good afternoon, Ray. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Welcome back to the program. Have you seen any interesting birds in the last month since we've seen you?
Everyone I've seen so far.
Everyone is interesting?
That's exactly right.
That can't be true.
Well, it's kind of. Anyway, yeah, a few good things. You know, the big splash in the bird world now, and it's something that is sort of predictable, but you don't ever expect it to be, and that is the late season hummingbirds.
Really?
And they're showing up in their totally unexpected places. The best of the bunch is this thing called a black chin hummingbird.
Really? I did not know birds had chins.
Well, it's kind of the place on the face.
Yeah.
But in any event, it's this is a close relative to our ruby-throated hummingbird.
Mm-hmm.
And never before seen in New York State. It's a western hummingbird
Why
species.
Why are they here? Why now?
Well, every now and then, birds of all sorts get off course.
Yeah.
And this one happened to show up at a place where people said, that looks different. It's in a city park in New York City. And the parks people there said, it's a hummingbird, but not one I'm familiar with. They took some video pictures of it, and the thing has a peculiar way of hovering, like hummingbirds do, but it has its own way of doing it. And it came down to people saying, whoa, this is not our usual late winter hummingbird. It's a new late winter hummingbird.
Interesting. You know, our bee bomb is now gone, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
Do you have to have a feeder, a hummingbird feeder, for any chance to see these, or will they just be passing by?
Both ways. I mean, yeah. There are some very hardy late blooming flowers that are out there, salvia. The different varieties of salvia, one of the, or pineapple sage, or some of these others.
Mm.
But in any event, yeah, a feeder helps. But the problem with it, especially up around our way, is that feeders freeze. And
yeah.
So, you know, even if they were to knock on your door, it'd be kind of hard pressed. Some people have heated hummingbird feeders.
Oh, come on.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Isn't that overkill?
Well, no, if you like hummingbirds, it's kind of like a way to do it.
I suppose.
And
it's cheating in a way.
Well, all of it is cheating.
All
I mean,
right.
Starting with the hummingbird itself. But in any event, it's not a good thing. I mean, these hummingbirds that do go off course like that, probably not a good future for them unless they figure it out fast. But some of them, and we've been watching the Rufous hummingbird, which is another western bird species, and wasn't too long ago that the first documented occurrence here in New York State showed up in Washington County, New York. And nowadays, we've been getting one a year someplace.
Huh.
And so clear evidence that some of them are returning favorites. And if you want to see a rufous hummingbird east of the Mississippi, the best place to go is down to Georgia or South Carolina or Florida.
Fair enough.
You know, kind of like they find themselves down there, maybe surviving longer down there.
The number to call here if you have a bird question is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Rich Guthrie is here. Jeffrey in Coxsackie says, I've noticed seeing robins around for the past 2 to 3 weeks. Will they stay or fly south?
Actually, both.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. The robin is a partially migrant bird. A local population may migrate south, a northern population may migrate in.
Ah.
Nonetheless, we have them all year round. In the wintertime, they're a little more reclusive. They find a good spot and they hang in there. They come back to the same spots as a group. They cluster as a community and spend the night together with maybe a dozen, 100, 1,000. And then daytime, they fan out to the countryside. So, yeah, we can expect to see American robins year-round here.
I noticed on your hat you have an oriole.
Yes, the New Baltimore
Very
oriole.
Very nice. How can somebody such as myself tell the difference between a robin and an oriole?
It's lots of different ways.
Yeah.
I mean, subtle, not so subtle stuff.
Yeah.
First of all, the oriole will be up in a tree. The robin will likely be on the ground, hopping around.
Fair enough.
And the placement of the black and orange or red on the bird will make a difference. When it comes to the females, forget about it. The female Baltimore oriole is primarily greenish yellow, with sort of tan markings on the wing and tail, whereas the male has bright flashes of orange on the wing, on the tail, and a different color orange than the robin redbreast has, which is kind of like a brick red coloration.
We've had many a robin this year in our yard, in our backyard. I don't know, do orioles get this far up? Do we see them around here?
In the summertime, yes.
Yeah?
Very rare in the wintertime, and it's usually young individuals that just didn't get the memo that get out of town.
All right, this email is from Kevin. I have a 1994 SVX coupe that's in need of an oil change and a new pan that I can't find. Is there some other pan that would work?
If you put a heated hummingbird feeder out there, you might get hummingbirds.
Oh, you know what? I think he's writing for next week.
Thought I'd offer that.
That's very nice. Thank you very much, and that'll do. This is from Susanna in Bern. How and when should the birdhouses be properly cleaned?
I just cleaned the bluebird box out yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
And, yes, now's a good time because you may find that the field mice have moved in for the winter, and bluebirds will actually use a nest box for overnight roosting. So you want to make it available for them and not so much for the mice. The mice can take care of themselves
now,
elsewhere.
When you say overnight roosting, they come back every night or it's like a Motel 6 and then they're on the road?
No, if they find a good, safe spot, they'll come back. And not only will one, but two, but three, but five, but six, but eight will share the same nest box as a communal roost. And it's, for a cold winter night, it's a handy thing to have.
All right, this is from another person named Rich. Small world, eh?
Nice guy, he's got to be.
Rich writes, I've been feeding the birds at my home in Fulton County on the border of Saratoga County for over 30 years. My home is in a mixed rural area with mature forest and neighboring fields. I've always had multiple birds of that sort of species you'd expect to find in this environment. Since early September, the number of the birds at my feeder has reduced dramatically. There were no birds at all until about the past several weeks. I've never experienced this situation. What do you think?
I think they have better choices. And no slight on you. I mean, thank you for putting your effort out there. But they're finding natural food on their own, which is their preferred food. So the birds that would be coming to your bird feeder are out there feasting on berries and grains and other things. Rest assured, when it starts getting colder and snowier and stormier, I think you'll find them coming right back to you.
You ever see a spruce grouse?
I have.
Yeah, we did a show with the folks from the DEC last week.
Yes.
Angelina Ross and Jeremy
That's a wonderful
Hurst.
Story, the effort being put into the spruce grouse. It's a wonderful bird.
Yeah. Okay. But their habitat is sort of...
Very limited. They're
disappearing
very specialized.
To some extent because... they needed quite a bit of old school or mature forest.
Yes, yeah. And they're confined in New York State and in Vermont and northern New Hampshire and the like to boreal bogs, very boggy situations in the high peaks of the Adirondacks and the similar Green Mountains and Northeast Kingdom of Vermont and the like.
Yeah.
But of course, when you get up into Canada and then go across to Manitoba and the like, it'll be a little more comfortable there.
All right, this is from Josh, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. The number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll check the email bag again in a bit. This is not yet. Wait for it. We'll do one more email. Mike Bowen on the board today. It's been a long day for Michael. He's in for Zach, and you've been on since about, 3 in the morning. So I'll cue you, buddy. Now, this is from Josh. I watch a locust tree from my hot tub. Normally, there's not very much bird activity this time of year. On Sunday, in the pouring rain, there were multiple birds climbing the tree eating insects. Just curious if there was a correlation between the rain and the birds on the tree. Are the insects more active or easier to access when it's raining? Do the birds even care that it's raining? And that's from Josh.
They don't care that it's raining, number one. They have to deal with that every rainy day. And as far as the insects are concerned, I think, first of all, I'd be curious to know what kind of birds they were, because usually these overwintering insect-eating birds are solitary loners. And not likely to find more than one in a group.
Yeah.
Maybe two or three, extended family.
All right.
So I'd be curious to know what kind of these guys are. And it could happen. You get a passing flock of, let's say, waxwings or something, and all of a sudden, you're the guest room is full.
So it's entertainment in the old hot tub for Josh.
In the locust tree out the window.
All right. Let's have a little break now there, Mr. Bowen. Hit that music. Ah, the beautiful Henry Mancini and the orchestra. lovely, lovely music. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. That's from the Peter Gunn soundtrack, don't you know? Henry Mancini, late 50s, one of the more mellow ones when Peter Gunn is in the bar late at night having a cocktail with his girl,
Easy listening.
Remember that show?
I do.
Yeah, great soundtrack. 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie and I are here to chat about music and birds. Let's go to the phones. Tom is in Gardner, New York. Tom, you're on.
Okay. Hello, Ray and Rich. I could listen to you talk about birds all day. Great, great job.
That's nice.
I have a question about a blue jay. I have a tree outside in the back, and the birds go there, and I throw peanuts, and they come get them. So I'm about 15 feet away from these things. Now, over the summer, one blue jay of this clan of like 7 or 8 that I have, its head was completely free of feathers.
Naked.
Except for, its head looked black.
Yeah.
As if it had a coating of very close, tight, bluish-black feathers. But besides that, I saw the complete shape of its head. It was like looking at a flicker or a sandpiper or something.
Right. Yeah.
And then the rest of its body was totally unaffected.
Yeah, that's a curious thing that happens with some jays.
For about a week at different times, I'd feed it, and it would come down and get a peanut. And, I'm just wondering, what happened?
Nothing.
To this blue jay?
Nothing really out of the ordinary. There is a bunch of blue jays out there that go through this feather molt, and a few of them choose to do it do it all at once on the head. All the feathers, psst, gone.
Wow.
And it makes them look real weird, really strange.
Yeah.
And but then they all grow back. It's all normal. It's all kind of bad timing, I guess.
Oh.
They could do a better job of distributing the molt sequence, but they don't.
There you go.
And
They sure look different without that crest and all those feathers, I'm telling you.
I know. And
it's
not
weird.
Exactly attractive either. I mean, it's kind of like,
I don't think we need to make value judgments here.
That's all you got for a head.
Wow.
Yeah, sort of like put your pants on.
Let's go easy on the Blue Jays fellas.
Yeah.
Hey, come on. Hey, Tom, thanks for the call. Wow, you guys are a tough crowd. 800-348-2551. If you'd like Rich to, make fun of your favorite favorite bird, give us a call. 800-348-2551. WM is in Roxbury. What's the WM stand for?
William.
Ah, oh, fair enough. We could have put that down. You're on.
Hi.
Okay, Rich. I've had a hummingbird feeder on my deck for about 20 years, and I have some observations I'd like to share with you. First of all, I take note of when they show up. It's usually around the middle of May.
Okay.
It's been earlier and earlier every year. So the hummingbirds will show up where the hummingbird feeder should be, that they expect will be there, and they go to the exact spot even though it's not there. How can they do that? I mean,
they got good memories and they like you very, very much. This happens to me,
well,
the same thing. And you know it's the same individual that left in September is back in May, and he knows where he wants to be, and that's right there. They got good memories.
That's what I figured. Now, another observation. They take a sip from the feeder, and then it's the glass bulb above it has the sugar solution in it, and they hover up, and they're clearly looking to check the level of the fluid. They go right to where the meniscus is. So that requires like some sort of built-in knowledge of volume and physics and math.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, well,
it's unbelievable.
I guess they're taking inventory and they're probably, you know, ready to send you a memo.
This is the kicker. When they sense that the level is getting very low, I sit at my dining room table, which is right adjacent to the deck, and there's glass sliding doors. They can see into the kitchen here, and they fly to the sliders. And they give me the evil eye, like, come on, man.
Well, you know, I give them credit for being able to do that. I think it's kind of easy to dismiss it. But on the other hand, I'm a fan of giving them credit for, you know, having the wherewithal.
They have a brain maybe the size of a peanut or smaller.
Are you talking about hummingbirds?
Size of a pea.
Yeah.
And they have this incredible... brain power. I just can't believe it.
Well, these are the guys that can navigate from your backyard in Roxbury all the way down to the Yucatan, Mexico, across the Gulf of Mexico, or perhaps southern Florida, and back again, and show up at that exact spot where the hummingbird feeder was supposed to be, and you didn't put it up yet. Well, yeah, they deserve a lot of credit.
What's their lifespan?
How long do they live for?
Well, that's the unfortunate thing.
2 or 3 years, maybe?
Yeah, you know, expect 2 or 3 years, and an old one would be maybe 5 years old. I don't know what the record length for, but it's hard to tell unless you're banding
these
them.
These are all ruby-throated hummingbirds.
Correct.
And the juvenile ones don't have the ruby throat. They have like a white throat?
Yes, correct.
Is that right?
Yes, and as do the females. So...
okay.
But in any event, yeah, good job on that. Keep good notes.
Appreciate the call. Now, this whole business of having a pea-sized brain and then having this analytical power, we'll put aside the alleged analytical power of looking at the level in the in the vessel. But this memory business, how have you been able to quantify the memory in a hummingbird?
I have not, other than by anecdotal observations, and that is when I'm sitting on my back deck, or as William out there in Roxbury, recognized that these birds were coming back to the exact spot where the feeder was or should have been.
When they travel, correct me if I'm wrong, but birds, they travel, they use magnetic lines of force, right?
That's one of the elements, yeah.
So maybe it's just, this is my path, this is the magnetic line of force I like.
Very, very true. And I think there is a certain amount of pathway that these many different birds use, using the exact same corridor. I and others have caught the same individual bird years apart in the same minuscule net lane. And so you know that this bird that was nesting in Canada on its way to South America came down the very same lane.
Isn't that amazing?
10 meters wide.
So theoretically, then, the hummingbirds that we see in our backyard every year for a couple years in a row might be the same ones.
Could be.
That is cool.
And that's where the individual, that's where this wandering business comes into play. The ones that get off track, they may be the pioneers of a new colony of a different species in a new area.
Uh-huh.
And there's plenty of evidence of that going on out there. And, for example, there's a there's a European bird species called the wheatear. And the wheatear nests in Europe, but they also fly across and nest in northern Canada. The Canadian ones follow the same historic or traditional migration pattern back to England, down to France, across to Spain, down into Africa, all the way down to Senegal and below.
Wow.
And then fly back up again, of course, Greenland, back to Canada.
Wow.
I mean, they, you know, these learned patterns. But now we're seeing that perhaps a few of them are discovering that it's just as easy to go down to the east coast of North America, to Georgia or Florida, rather than going all the way across to back to England.
So those are the trailblazers.
These may be the beginnings of a new pattern.
Interesting. You know, my wife and I were talking about the pending magnetic pole shift on the Earth the other day, because one scientist, and they're saying this from time to time, oh, it might happen very soon.
Yes.
Of course, it might take 20,000 years. But what do the birds do if the South Pole is now the North Pole and
chaos.
The North Pole now is the South Pole?
Chaos.
Really?
All around us. I think so. I mean, they're so so strongly ingrained to use magnetic pathways. And this may be, you know, the shifting of the magnetic pole over to Siberia may be causing some of these redistributions of birds, that like the black-chinned hummingbird in New York City, Wrangell Island.
Well, something's happening. In the old days, it would move maybe 30 feet a year. Now it's about 500 feet a year.
I remember the old Boy Scout compass where you need to do the declination, little computation every year. There was nothing. Now you need a computer to figure that stuff out.
You know, we digress.
We do.
Should we talk about Henry Mancini music again? Or you want to take it?
About that car.
Oh, the car.
Yes, we could go back to
the oil
pan.
All right, we'll get back to that one later. Right now, let's go to Newburgh, and Glenn is on. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, howdy, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
You touched on cleaning out bluebird boxes. Now, my question was, if there's already grass in there, which, you know, we know bluebirds like to use, should you clean it out anyway?
Sure. Sure. Why not?
Yeah.
And
to get pests and stuff like that out?
Yeah, they will remake whatever furnishings they need in there. Well, let me backpedal here a little bit because you maybe not. Give it a good, perhaps here's what I would suggest. Give it a shaking or some, you know, stir it up with a stick or something and then put it back in again. For the winter, just insulation. And the reason why I say that, there may be some parasites in there, or the mice may be in there, and you're evicting them and making it hospitable for bluebirds overnight.
Okay. And plus, you know, I was kind of figuring that, it'll be that much less energy they have to expend on going and getting that stuff too, right?
Good thought, yes. So, yes, you are correct.
Alrighty.
Keep it in there.
All right, Glenn.
Thank you very much, guys.
Appreciate the call. To Altamont we go, and it's Barb. Hello there, Barb.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so I have two questions. One is that we have a lot of great blue herons that visit our pond this time of year. Mm-hmm. Are they just passing through, or are they local?
Both, same as with the robins earlier, the great blue herons, being fish and frog eaters, will want to migrate south for the winter, and they do. A few will linger longer, and a very, very few will actually stay over winter, and they're doing that at great risk and peril, because the fish and frogs are going to be hard to come by. But we've seen where those guys may be able to figure out that their mice taste is about as good as a fish and meadow voles and the like, so you'll find them out in a cornfield.
Surf and turf. That's nice.
Yeah, surf and turf.
Yeah, we've seen them hunting voles and mice in our yard.
Yes, but they do that at great peril, because if you get a deep snowfall or a freeze-up, they may go hungry for a few days. So
okay.
Is there anything I can do?
No.
To help them?
No. I don't recommend. I would say, you can kind of wish them well and urge them to move on because they really ought to get out of town.
All right.
Yeah, that's what I keep thinking. Why are you still here?
Uh-huh.
Well, thanks, Barb.
And my other question is, what do you know about the population of the American woodcock in our local woods? I've always had them around here. I'm seeing fewer, but we always had them.
Well, a lot depends on your local environment. Out where, first of all, the American woodcock is an incredible sandpiper bird that lives in the forest. It's given up the sand for the leaves of the forest, and they nest on the ground. They need a certain amount of undisturbed area in which to nest and raise their young. And there's been a lot of encroachments and habitat disappearance. And so areas where there is still sustainable habitat available, I think the woodcock population is still good. But in areas where suburban sprawl or intrusions into the fields where they nest, it just kind of makes it harder for them to raise a family, and then the numbers will decline. Also, they're very vulnerable to ground predators, especially outdoor cats. And so something to help them along on that is to keep the old cats indoors.
All right, Barb. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Barb.
Getting back to the blue heron for a moment, I've seen exactly one, and it's a spectacular sight to see him swoop in on the pond. Yeah. And so you mentioned they hang around. They got to live someplace, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do they just float on the water at the end of the working day, or where do they
live? Oh, no. The great blue heron, big and awkward-looking and gargantuan as they appear to be, and totally clumsy.
Yeah.
They perch in the top of tall trees.
You're kidding me.
Seriously.
Be easy to spot.
They would be. They nest. And when it comes to nesting, it's the most unusual situation. They build a sticky, just a flimsy stick nest at the very top of dead trees in a swamp. And that's where they lay their eggs and raise their young, two or three young, in this flimsy nest on a tree that looks like it ought to fall down. Incredible, that chances they take.
That is incredible.
There's plenty of good, solid terra firma down there. If they were ground nesters, things would be so much better for them.
Indeed. Rich Guthrie is our guest today. It's birds on the program. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Julie Hart is not with us today. She'll be with us again next month when we do this program. 800-348-2551. One more call, then we'll take a break, then we'll check the email bag, then we'll hit the calls again. Got it?
Got it. I'm with you.
Roger Wilco. All right, here we go. Marion in Saugerties, you're on.
Hi there. I've been keeping track of birdwatch for the Cornell Lab, documenting, backyard birds in your yard.
Sure.
And so I've been looking at one feeder. And they ask you to document how many birds you see at the feeder. And it's a little confusing to know how many there actually are in a group of any particular bird species at the feeder. And I was curious if you had any hints on, I can see there are, let's say, 6 to 10 of them gathered around in the trees, but they kind of swoop in and out. Is there somewhere I could look to determine the size of groups that travel together, I just don't know how to estimate how many birds there are in total.
I've never been able to figure that out either.
Well, neither have I. So,
what?
And so what you're going to do is you're going to give it a best guess effort. And one way of doing it would be to take a photo and count the birds in the picture. But, there's it's very, very difficult. And I'll assure you, more than likely, you're going to underestimate the number that are coming there. What you're talking about is Cornell University's Project Feeder Watch, and they do ask you to take a census of how many birds are there. What they don't want you to do, and what for obvious reasons, is keep a running tally, adding one more as each bird shows up.
I have 3,000 birds.
Yeah, exactly, at the end of the day. And we see that happen every now and then. People, it's good intentions, but it's the wrong formula. So the best guess method is what you can work with. And they're looking for orders of magnitude. And so, if you've got 15 red poles coming to your feeder, well, that's 15 red poles. There may be 75 of them out there, but over the course of time, that number will begin to become a representative figure. And if it goes down to three or two or none, they know that there's something going on.
Huh.
And so the exact count statistically is just a tool to measure the comings and goings of the numbers. The other possibility is to, you can get, you know, it's kind of like a fun game is to get some coffee beans or grains of rice or raisins or something, and then take a handful, scatter them on a table, and try to use that a scanning skill to estimate the numbers, and then count and see how well you do.
Yeah. The birds won't eat the coffee beans, though, right?
Well, if you keep them indoors, the...
Oh, I see. You're not feeding the birds.
Oh,
okay.
no,
okay,
on your kitchen table.
Yeah, the bird's really wired.
This is a parlor game we're talking about here.
Fair enough.
Yes. So, that way you can develop a more educated guess as to numbers. And we use that a lot when we're out there counting crows overhead or sandpipers on a mud flat or ducks on a pond. You know, you just sort of count through fives or tens or maybe say swoop 121.
Fair enough. Marion, we got to take a break here. Before we hit that break, now, this feeder project, it's completely voluntary, right?
It is, yes. Cornell University.
But yet, if some people really aren't getting it, they're doing it wrong, do you ever just say, hey, look, I'm sorry, you're fired, you can't do this?
No? Not my job.
All right. Well,
I do that with eBird, but not with Feeder Watch.
All right, let's take a break here. Rich Guthrie, so much fun. 800-348-2551 when we talk birds. We'll be back and check the email back. Jimmy Cleveland and his All-Stars from along about 1955. Little Beaver was the name of that one here on Vox Pop. He wrote that with Quincy Jones. I bet you knew that, though.
It was coming to me slowly.
Rich Guthrie, usually you do your list, and I understand it's truncated today. What's up with that?
Kind of. It's very simple.
All right, go.
It's simple yet complex.
All right.
And that is, of all the activities going on right now, the big one coming up is the annual Audubon Society Christmas Bird Count.
Ooh, okay.
Here, there, and everywhere. And you can go to Audubon Society's webpage and look up to see Christmas Bird Count. If you're in one of the 15-mile diameter circles, be involved. Even if you don't want to get out and walk out in the snow and trudge through the mud and cold, you can watch from your back window if you had a bird feeder going. They welcome that opportunity for the most part.
Okay. And then how do you find out about it?
Audubon Society. If you have a local bird club or Audubon chapter, they will be your first point of contact because they will have the local information. But if you don't know if you are or not within one of these count circles, go to the online to look up National Audubon Society Christmas Bird Counts. And they have a map, and you could look at it and see where you're where you are and with respect to an active count circle.
Now, just full disclosure, I would never do this because the game is on, but I would be in charge of the whole 15-mile diameter of this thing.
Negatory.
All right, so how does that work?
They're going to give you they're going to assign you to a team. You'll join up with that team, and you all work together and cooperate with one another. And or you can sit in your lounge chair, look out the window, and count the birds, 1, 5, 10, 15, coming to your bird feeder. If you're in the count circle, they welcome that information.
What if, let's just say, the recently departed New York congressman who had some issues with veracity, what if he joined up and he was a total fraud? What happens?
We have people.
Okay. What do you mean, we have people?
We have people. The compiler will screen through that stuff and say, prove it.
Okay.
You know, you got pictures or it didn't happen, that kind of thing.
All right. So, you know, don't do that. If you're out of Congress and you're looking for something to do, don't do that, right?
You really don't want to do that. You know, small gain.
All right. Fair enough. This email from Marina. How do you get rid of annoying merlins? I can't put out any bird feeders because they prey on the beautiful songbirds in my yard. Any suggestion on how to permanently get rid of these annoying creatures? And that's from Marina. That's pretty strong.
Yes, it is. And I empathize, but You can't do anything about it. Other than to cut off the food supply, stop feeding the birds, and the Merlin, if it is a Merlin, which I kind of suspect isn't. But
why?
Well, Merlins are scarce, and they tend to wander further. More than likely, it's a Sharpshin hawk.
Ah.
And they have a way of moving in and overstaying their welcome.
Okay.
And feasting on the little birds at the feeder. So, you know, you're just going to have to cut off the food supply for a little while, because they're going to stick around as long as you keep tossing out bird seed for the birds for them to eat.
This question is from Susanna in Bern. Didn't we have a question from
Susanna? Susanna, a lovely name.
Oh, Susanna, don't you cry. All right. Is store-purchased suet really safe for the birds?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I've had some bad experience, not bad experience, but kind of rejection of the stuff you get on sale at some of these big
finicky birds.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, it sits there and sits there and sits there until I decide I'm going to get another kind and put it out. And then it disappears in a hurry. Because
you probably spoil those birds, Rich. They know they come to you for the good stuff.
Well, yeah, count on it.
Really? All right, this is from David in Kingston. A couple of years ago, I found a beautiful barred owl wing feather on my street near my house. Within a day or two, while walking my dog in my neighborhood, found another one, practically a mirror image of the first one. I think it was the same individual. What do you think?
Probably, and it's nothing unusual because all birds, at least once a year, drop each and every one of their feathers. Big ones and small ones, wings and tails and head and the like.
But you're not allowed to pick them up, right?
Well, technically, no. I mean, there's federal laws against doing that, and for good reason, because people were shooting birds just to get a hold of their feathers.
Right.
And if you're having a feather there and you say, oh, no, I found it on the street, and they say, well, you know, we suspect you actually shot that bird.
Right.
They don't want to, you know, they say, okay, everybody out of the pool.
All right. This is from Peg. Birds are much more intelligent than most people believe. For example, Alex the Cag. I'd like to be a bird brain. What's an Alex the Cag? Do you know?
I have no idea.
C-A-G, is it some kind of bird?
I don't know. It sounds like a video game.
Alex the Cag, yeah, or Felix the Cat would kill Alex the Cag, theoretically. Fran in Gallatin writes, the male cardinal with an injured wing that I rescued from being squashed in the road has survived, and I see him at his lady now and then at my feeder. Question, where are Canada geese going right now? I can hear them, but I can't see them.
From the pond that isn't frozen yet to the cornfield that doesn't have snow on it. They're just commuting back and forth from the work to the bedroom community to pond.
All right. Paul and Reinbeck, how likely is it that our winter birds will roost in our bird boxes?
Not very. Most winter birds don't roost in bird boxes. Some do. The Carolina wren will. The bluebirds may. Some downy woodpeckers, chickadees, and nuthatches may, but there are plenty of natural cavities out there that they will use in lieu of a nest box. But if you got one out there, you know, it could happen.
All right. David writes in, there are a lot, bird brains is the subject.
Okay.
There's a lot we've yet to learn about brains altogether. Brains aren't binary. They're wetware. Bearing in mind all the capabilities of ants and spiders, for example, there might be a possibility that we might be dealing with a form of quantum computing that we've yet to sort out.
I love it. I love it. Okay, let's work on that.
And then David reminds me that Herschel Bernardi was the detective in the Peter Gunn show. He was great. Remember that?
Dun, 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 dun.
All right. And you know what? Let's go back to the phones. Rich Guthrie's our guest. Ken is in Albany. Ken, you're on.
Hello, Peter Gunn. It's a Henry Mancini theme song there.
That's correct.
Little callback. Listen, the caller that was several minutes ago wondering about how could a tiny little hummingbird with a brain the size of maybe a large bean be so intelligent as to know its way around and remember. I've studied brain science to a limited extent, but I can tell you there's research and pathology done on birds, and anatomically, birds have up to twice as many neurons in their brains as, say, like a chimpanzee, several primates. The neurons are packed much more densely inside a bird's brain, and it's not just the number of neurons that determine the processing power, intelligence, if you will, but it's really down to how many connections and the quality and the extent of the connections among the neurons in the brain that produce storing power and processing power. So there some, especially among the parrots and corvids, crows and ravens and such, they have the brain power comparable to some large primates.
Well, the thing,
they have little tiny brains.
It is amazing. And their evolutionary pathway took a different route than the mammalian route. And they're coming through some serpentine, reptilian, and the like. And so, you know, there are, and I appreciate what you're saying there, what we're comfortable with appreciating things we can understand and see better, and the things that we can't, well, we try to interpret in the way that we can understand it. And, you know, so we underappreciate what you're saying is true. There's just so much going on in that little package. So big is not always better.
Ken, thanks for the call. It's Birds Today with Richard P. Guthrie, 800-348-2551. Speaking of Richard P. Guthrie, if people want to get a hold of you and show the pictures of the blue-footed booby or whatever they took, how do they do that?
Very same way. It's richardpguthrie@gmail.com.
How do you spell Guthrie?
G-U-T-H-R-I-E.
Aha!
Just like Olo and Woody.
All right. 800-348-2551 is our number right now. It's Birds with Rich Guthrie. Will is in Brattleboro. Will, you're on.
Hi, I was just calling about blue herons and wanted to let you know. Years ago when I used to take the train to New York City from Dover Plains, there was a huge rookery in the swamp on the right side of the train just before you got to the Harlem Valley Wingdale stop. And it was always amazing in the springtime to see so many herons there attending their chicks. Just something else I thought I'd point out there about them and hope that people get to see them again. Thanks very much.
Thanks for the call. Do you remember that, Rich?
I do. And when you do see one of those heron rookeries, it is always impressive. There's one, if you're traveling along the New York Thruway west of Syracuse, there's one just west of the Montezuma National Wildlife Refuge. And you can see that from your car window. Or coming up from the New York Thruway past New Paltz, you look out your window to the east side. There's another rookery, you know, clearly high up and very visible when it's occupied. Right now, all the leaves are gone. You can probably see the remnants of the stick nests on the top of these dead trees.
You know, I've seen the Montezuma thing out on the thruway. It's beyond Syracuse, right?
Yes, it
between
is.
Syracuse and Rochester.
Correct.
Why did they call it Montezuma? Was he up this way at one time?
There's a community there called Montezuma, New York.
Okay.
And I would like to know the connection between the halls of Montezuma and Montezuma, New York.
That's your homework for the next show.
Okay, we'll work on it.
Yeah, I don't think you will.
By the way,
Alex the Cag.
Okay, thank you.
Cag wrote back, Congo African gray.
Okay, good. Okay.
Do you know about Alex, the Congo African gray?
I know about African grays, and they are very intelligent. Some of them have an incredible vocabulary that they have learned. Citiforms, or the parrots of the world, tend to show an incredible amount of intelligence. And
but they don't know what they're saying. If I run into a minor bird, it's not going to...
They're not going to tell you a story or interpret something you said in some way. They're going to repeat what they've heard. And some trigger is going to cause them to repeat it on cue, but not necessarily with meaning.
And have they done any studies? If I'm next to a talking bird and I maybe drop an F-bomb only once, will it pick that up?
Oh, there's so many humorous jokes out there about that.
No, what I'm saying is do you have to repeat things for these birds?
I don't think so. I think if they happen to like it,
really?
Then it's going to be maybe at your own peril, you know.
I gotta try that.
At the distress of the pastor's wife.
All right, get me a parrot. Let's have an experiment. Daniel in Rosendale, you're on.
Hi, this is Daniel Shara. I love your show.
Thanks.
I'm asking Rick's reaction to this, actually. A few years ago, I feed the birds in the backyard. I stepped out, and I was just sort of saying, oh, I wonder if they're watching humans, too. And they say, oh, there's a human, there's a male. And I wondered if they could recognize an individual. So I began paying attention to recognizing individual birds. And the blue jays and the mourning doves in particular, have unique spots on their back. Blue jays kind of have a unique pattern in the back and on the front. And if you really start seeing several of them together, and it's particularly good in the winter, they seem to group together more. Yeah, you can start saying, oh, that's morning jay, you know, I mean, I started doing it like left, right. So there's morning jay 11, 17, hanging out again with number 6, 12, and they seem like maybe they're a pair. Anyway, it's just another level of bird watching. Instead of seeing, oh, there's a species, you can say, oh, that's an individual, and start paying attention to that.
Cool. Very, very good idea. And you learn a lot by watching the behavior of one individual amongst the others. And you know, somebody just sent me a photograph of what we call a sport that is a partially leucistic or a partial albino bird, little patches of white, a sport we used to call it.
All right.
And watching those individuals that stand out individually from the crowd, you can pay attention to their comings and goings and interactions with the rest of the bunch.
All right. Hey, Daniel, thanks a lot. Good call. Appreciate it. This email from Lou. We keep a small bird bath on our patio year-round. Wondering if adding warm water in the winter is good or bad.
Not a bad thing.
Really?
Not a bad thing. You know, the birds, and some people actually, there's a popular product out there, that a plug-in bird bath heater.
Oh, do you have one?
I do not.
Good
no.
for you. You are old school, Rich Guthrie. All right.
Let the poor thing suffer.
Yeah. No, I'm just... Now, wait a minute. Let's go to Holly in Saratoga. Holly, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have two questions about bluebirds. I live in the suburbs and I have bluebirds in my backyard since February 17. They showed up because of the heated bird bath, actually, I think. And I put a worm feeder out there. Here's my first question.
Okay.
Not this summer, but the summer before, the male bluebird actually did this strange behavior. I have a bay window from my kitchen that looks out. And I have a hummingbird feeder in front of that. He hung on to the string on top of the hummingbird feeder, just sat there looking in my window into the kitchen. And I couldn't believe it. But he did this repeatedly for minutes at a time. And I thought, is he looking at me or is he seeing his own reflection? So I took a ladder and I went out there on the deck and I climbed up to where he was. And I could see in the window. It wasn't my reflection. So...
Okay.
This is strange to me. Have you ever heard of it? That's my first question.
Got
this
about
kind
a
of behavior. He looked like he was watching me.
Got about a minute left here, Rich. So go ahead.
Well, sounds like the bluebird had good taste. He was one of your admiring fans.
That's nice.
And I wouldn't put it past him. I think they learn. I have had similar sorts of things, but I don't take personal credit for it because I think they're right. They got. They just latch on to a figure, a person, or a likeness, and I think you've found a friend, an admirer.
All right,
I put the worms out.
Well, there
I
you
put
go.
The worms
that,
out. So
that would do it. It's
my
sort of
last
like
question. I know
about 45 seconds, Holly. So go ahead.
Yeah. So I already cleaned out my bluebird house and scrubbed it with Clorox because I heard I should. Should I now put something in it in case I want to use it for Motel 6 this winter?
Yeah, sure. You can put some clean cuttings or grass or dry grass or hay.
Okay.
Or, just a little bit. Just a carpet on the floor.
Thanks, Holly. Appreciate the call. Very quickly, this email from Jay in Chester, New York. Other day, there was a sudden arrival of thousands of blackbirds, maybe grackles, in my yard. They came in waves, and then suddenly they were gone. What kind of birds do you think they were?
Generically, blackbirds. A group, probably a mixed bunch of grackles, as you point out, red-winged blackbirds, cowbirds, and perhaps a rusty blackbird, and maybe a yellow-headed blackbird. But they are just passing through.
We saw that last year in our yard, and it was incredible. All the other birds ran for cover or flew.
You know what's amazing is that as a group, they're suddenly very, very loud, then they suddenly stop.
Yep.
Stop. Like, what triggered that stop? It's not like they tape it off. It was just like, done.
Terrifying.
It's
nature
wonderful.
Is terrible. Hey, Rich Guthrie, once again, how do people find you?
RichardPGuthrie@gmail.com.
Well, that was fast.
Of course.
A lot
That's
of fun.
Easy. I remembered it.
Support comes from Rhinebeck Artist Shops, offering fine artist materials and custom picture framing in Rhinebeck at New Paltz, serving the Hudson Valley for over 45 years. HudsonValleyArtistShops.com. Avila, independent retirement community, featuring a maintenance-free lifestyle with gourmet dining, housekeeping, daily activities, and more. Rental options now available. AvilaLiving.com. and Temple Sinai, Saratoga Springs, New York, an open congregation welcoming the Jewish community and visitors for Shabbat and holiday services, cultural services at more, saratogasinai.org for details. Once again, thanks to Rich Guthrie for being here today. Thank you for calling, and we'll do it again next month. Julie Hart will be back with us. We'll have another bird show. Stand by for that one. Thanks to, Mike Bowen is still awake over there at the board. Well done, sir. Thanks to Ed Rosen, screen the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Get out your hammer. Get out your T-square, whatnot. It's Home Improvement tomorrow at 2 with Darren Tracy. We'll see you for that.